Welcome to ADHD is Over, a new podcast on a seemingly old label that we're going to be peeling off. Join my wife, Tatiana, and I as we journey with our family, the Wyden family, through the land of confusing information. We're going to visit both sides and let you decide because the power is with you. Welcome to ADHD is Over.
Hello and welcome back to our podcast. Glad you're here. If you're returning, welcome back. If you're new, welcome, welcome. So good to have you. Remember, our new sponsor, Zero, Z-H-E-R-O, a powerful hyper-focused energy drink formulated in the UK from just the most amazing people who do great research, who wanted to create natural product that doesn't give you jitters, and it allows for the smooth effect of caffeine versus the really kind of crashy coffee effect that I often get when I drink, well, coffee. So check out Zero, Z-H-E-R-O, the link in the show notes. Check it out, check it out. Now let's get to it. My guest today is Lauren Duke. Lauren is a writer, educator, entrepreneur, and community activist. She's taught thousands of yoga students over the last 20 years, led dozens of international retreats, and continues to push the edge between yoga, mental health, and trauma. Lauren founded Gather Encinitas, a one-of-a-kind community center and yoga studio in Encinitas, California. She devotes her time to helping educate people on the anatomy of trauma and how those experiences are woven into our bodies and ultimately our lives. Lauren has studied with the world's leading trauma experts, such as Bessel van der Kolk, Peter A. Levine, Gabor Mate, and Stephen Porges. If those names sound familiar, you're right. They've all been on this podcast. Her debut memoir, Shithouse, was published in January of 2022. She's currently finishing graduate school, getting her master's in physiological psychology, and she's working on her second book. Busy woman, for sure. Lauren and I are going to talk about childhood trauma, the shit house, the importance of somatic healing, of course, ADHD, but also much more than just that. So listen in. Let me welcome my dear friend, Lauren Duke. Hey, Lauren.
Hey there.
It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, my pleasure. You're a busy woman. So your book, Shit House, is out and you're working on your second book. And it's interesting because when I hear that term, it just, to me, communicates like interesting childhood, rough childhood, crazy house. Is that where it all started?
I mean, it didn't all start in the house. It definitely started like before this particular house, just the way that I was raised. But yeah, the book is really, well, the book is about generational trauma, but there was... some very specific things that happened in that house that I won't give away. I'll just wait for people to read the book.
You have to read the book. We'll put a link in the show notes so our listeners can get the book and check it out. Well, the reason why I asked that is because, you know, we both agree for the most part, I would imagine, on the effect of trauma on a nervous system, on a body, on a life, right? And you have studied with some of the same experts that I've interviewed. And they're all pointing at the same thing, that stuff happens in our childhood that affects who we become as adults, right?
Yeah.
So maybe let's start there. To you, what is ADHD? What is that thing?
Ooh, I mean, it's a neurodevelopmental disorder that to some extent we probably all have. And I believe, even though I think some people will disagree with me about this, but I think it's learned. There's a lot of learning.
Ooh, I like that
going
word.
On. And some of the symptoms are what we are all experiencing in like modernity to some extent, which is impulsiveness or a lack of or an inability to pay attention and hyperactivity. And I feel like just normal things. It's just kind of given this very intense label, even though we're a living process.
I love that. I want to just go back to the word learned. That's really cool. I haven't heard that yet.
I mean, some people are not going to want to. I believe that even our whole nervous system is learned.
Well, I mean, science says that our brain develops in relationship to the environment.
Yes.
So it's learning, right? Like an AI almost. And it's...
This is how I talk about this all the time, is AI. Like I'm always... Yeah, just because too. When people are... I think now so many people are very aware of social media algorithms, right? And sometimes I hear people say like, oh, this ad keeps following me around and now I'm getting more ads. Like, I don't understand it. It's like, no, it's learning. The algorithm is learning what you click on.
Yeah.
It's learning, you know, it's basically co-evolving with you. And yeah. So that's really the same thing as the nervous system. It's not fixed. It's a system that's constantly evolving and it's a learned process, which means the good news about that, I feel like when we say that something is learned, one, the reason why that triggers people so much is because there needs to be some level of accountability, right? Like we want to just have a thing that's from the outside. Oh no, it's just genetic. Right. I just have this thing.
The bad
and then,
guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you don't have to be responsible for like fixing it or healing it. But when something is learned, it can be unlearned.
You know?
And that's the, I feel like that's kind of the keystone of what I do.
I love that. And I want to get a little bit into that and where you started to kind of get interested in all of that and what you're doing with it. Right. But I love that. Like I say this all the time, that this is an empowering message. The news that, you know, you actually, as a parent, for example, with a child that's been diagnosed, you have the power to have them relearn, to rewire the brain or the nervous system by changing the environment, which includes parenting and school and food and everything, right?
Yeah.
The bad news is that you can no longer blame something outside of yourself.
I know, and that's the hard part, right? Okay, a few things. That's the first one, just the...
I like that.
Okay, so when I was a little kid, my mom did like a few good things. I mean, she's done, you know, many good things. One, she was a great cook. She taught me that, right? But one of the things that she did when I was a child that it made me like really think about her differently as an adult is when I was about going into kindergarten, you know, I was like 4.5 or 5 years old, the doctor diagnosed me with ADHD. And my mom said, she's busy. She doesn't have ADHD. They wanted to medicate me. My mom just put me out in the yard. So, I learned to be in the world in the yard rather than just sitting still. Like I learned how to be in the world through movement, playing in the yard. I was always climbing fences. I was always taking off. So like I have these pictures when I was a child and the fence was all these different colors because they kept having to build the fence higher every time I was like two years old climbing the fence, leaving, which says a lot about my childhood too. I was always avoidant, on the run, getting the hell out of here. But yeah, so my mom did not medicate me. She just, in her mind, she's like, no, this girl just needs an outlet. She put me into sports. Mm. So like I've always, I believe, well, just because it's my experience that like we're all full of all sorts of energy. And I think sometimes people have they don't understand how to transcend that energy through an outlet and maybe they're not taught. Right.
Yeah.
So I have a really good friend that I was just in Mexico with and she has ADD or ADHD. I think it's ADHD. And then her son was diagnosed with it. Right. There's all sorts of science now and evidence and research papers, empirically based research papers that are, you know, showing how these babies in the womb are, their neuroendocrine markers are literally like mirroring the mother.
Yeah.
So we're learning our nervous system from the parent, the care, you know, the parent whose womb we are in, but then, you know, through the caregivers that we're either attuning to or not attuning to. So when I think about my friend that I was in Mexico with, you know, I said to her, I showed her actually a research paper because I'm in graduate school right now. I showed her this research paper and it's on affect contagion, right? It's like on how our kind of like physiology is contagious. And then there was another one about children, you know, children learning their affect from their parents. And I gave her these papers and it was like really hard for her one, she was mad at me, you know, like I'm pointing the finger and blaming at her. I mean, blaming her, but
that's what we do, right? In society, I think there's this tendency to, I was watching a Dr. Phil show, it was a while back, and there was an executive from Pfizer there to promote ADHD medication. And she looks to the camera and she says, I just want you parents to know that it's not due to bad parenting, right? You're not a bad parent. And I go, I know what you're trying to do, but it's not about that. It's not you're a bad parent. It's actually that the parent, realizing what you just shared, that children co-regulate with their caregivers, have the power to transform themselves, and then the kids will transform.
Well, it's a long, hard look in the mirror for the parent that they don't, and especially for me not being a parent, I think, I mean, I don't say anything to parents. I just wanted her, I've been listening to this woman freak out about her child for many years, but then watching her not change her own life, you know, which impacts behavior and or change the conditions of her life, which is impacting her own physiological state. And then literally her son is the spitting image of her. Yeah. And she's one of the most talented, successful artists that I know. We always say that she has Willy Wonka in her head, and now her son has Willy Wonka in her. But so for the mother, she has learned some outlets to transcend her, that energy that she has inside of her. And she's a brilliant artist. So and she just needs to get some of these outlets in front of her child versus sitting her child on a couch where they don't have a way to discharge their energy. Like if you just look at animals in nature and the phylogeny of animals, like animals are always moving. They're always moving, and they're always doing something that's called pendiculation, which is this just like constant, like you see lions doing it all the time. It's like your limbs are kind of moving in opposite directions, or you're like stretching and yawning and like moving the jaw. And we've been very like culturally conditioned to not do any of those weird movements, which is all I teach in my classes, is like discharge stuff. Like you have to make sound because of the vagal connection. Mm-hmm. There's so many ways that you can discharge energy, but by staying still. And like, I didn't learn like normal kids. I needed to move. Yeah. If you sat me down in a desk and you said, be still, don't make any sound, don't move your head, don't move your eyes. Like, and then we're learning that. But then, well, this is creating kind of these subdued freeze responses in people that they end up ultimately taking into their adulthood.
I agree. And I love that what you, there's two things came up. One, I believe, let me do the other one first. So there's that famous video of, I forgot what animal it is that gets chased and hit or whatever, and then shakes it off.
Yeah, this is what I'm trained in, is somatic experiencing. Yeah. This is Peter Levine's
work.
Yeah. Peter
Levine's
work. It's an impala and a cheetah.
There we go.
Yeah.
Right? And to me, that's the example of, you could say, the opposite of what we're not doing when we're sitting kids down and giving them medication. Because if they've had traumatic things happen in life and we don't help them with somatic experiencing, or like, you know, to really heal it through the body and sound and so forth, then of course they're gonna be, I think it's like we're castrating most of our boys, because
totally,
that's so dulling to a man's or a boy's need to like shoot out the energy and run around and move and shake it off, right?
Yeah. And then, I mean, Taylor Swift she was onto something with her song Shake It Off. You know, it's like there's a science to this. And the interesting thing is, I mean, I know this because I have all these kind of like what some people would say, these fringe trainings, right? And so the reason why I went back to graduate school, and I don't know, I actually had a dream that I did go on to get my PhD in somatic psychology, which I said I wasn't going to do, but now I think I might do it. But the reason why I decided to go back and get my master's in, the emphasis is in physiological psychology, is because I wanted, you and I who have studied all this fringe stuff, we know that this is ancient medicine. This is wild animal medicine. This isn't like, you know, this is not weird fringe stuff. Actually, the stuff we're doing now is the weird stuff that we're doing, you know, just a lot of the Western medicine takes. But I really wanted to be able to reach mainstream people, like normal people who won't take you seriously unless, like, no one's going to come to my somatic experiencing workshop. And so instead, I use the forum of yoga to educate people on how the body mind works and how it's essentially a continuum, a boomerang.
But even there, you have more alternative people. It's getting more mainstream, of course.
It's getting way more mainstream. Like, yeah. I have, there's a record-breaking number of people doing yoga now, like billions of people doing yoga. So that, even though I've watched over the last several years, like so many of the, you know, like big teachers or the mainstream teachers leave the yoga template, leave the yoga forum because of all of these scandals. And, you know, it's just, I'm staying because it is the forum, like the amount of people that I can reach through yoga, because it is actually really trendy. Like people are going, whether they get dragged, whether they get, and then, you know, people show up in that room and I'm not teaching traditional stuff anymore. I'm teaching all sorts of, you know, interesting stuff, but it's captivating. Right.
Right.
And so Joe Schmo walks in and has a moment. It's like, huh, I can get Joe Schmo to come to yoga because it's trendy. It's everywhere. But I'm not going to get Joe Schmo to like come to my, you know, pandiculation workshop.
Like, sounds, you know, interesting though.
Yeah, I mean, to you, pandiculate, to you. Yeah.
No, but you're right. There are certain things that are still like fringe and like people don't go because it's not accredited or whatever, certified, or you don't have a diploma or
exactly.
a degree.
Exactly.
I get it. And that's, it's a little sad because, I mean, I run into the same thing. I was thinking of getting my master's as well in psychology. But then I decided, let me wait a little bit to see, because I don't want to lean on a degree to continue speaking the truth. Right.
Yeah.
And I can interview people with degrees and they can essentially, they agree with what I hypothesize.
Yeah.
Years later, I have an idea. Years later, Gabor Mate says, da, 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 it's a coping mechanism. I'm like, I thought about it. Yes, that's exactly what I was feeling. Now I know, you know. And you've studied with some of these people. And what do you think is the, you touched upon it with your friend, right? There's a hesitation to really, for the parent to kind of own it and to feel empowered that there's something they can do other than just a pill or say, oh, my child has a disorder, there's nothing I can do. What is the hesitancy about? Why do adults not, why don't they want to do the work?
Oh my gosh, come on. This just comes back to evolution, right? If you think about, we're pack animals. And if you just, you know, go back to, this is a big piece of somatic experiencing, is like understanding the phylogeny of a nervous system from animal to human being and how that evolves and the similarity between animals and humans, right? But if you just look at animals in a pack, and if one animal does something wrong, it's ousted. That could mean death. So for people, it makes sense that there's this kind of like inherent to have to hold yourself accountable for something that you feel bad about is such a deeply almost like death feeling, like shame, you know? Mm. And so I think it's I think if more people understood this evolution, it's almost like, oh, that's why that feeling is so intense. Like no one wants to be wrong.
Right.
No one wants to be bad. Yeah. Because if you look at our, you know, ancient animal history, if you're in a group of animals and you're bad or you're wrong or you're the bottom of that, you don't have a resource, you're not smart enough, you don't have good claws, like you're going to get ousted. And what does that mean? Death. Yeah. So I think that if you like the existential part of this is fear of death. That's like so deep.
So fear of death, but ultimately fear of embarrassment, fear of being shamed, fear
but
of.
But people don't understand that what's below that. It's just that it makes sense from an evolutionary perspective that.
It's time to let go though.
Don't, I know, but
it's time to let
this
go.
Is why educating people on how a mind body works or a body mind works is critical, because what all it does is it makes people go, oh, that's not that big of a deal. You know, oh, I'm feeling this because, or, oh my God, my heart rate is going crazy right now. why? What is happening in the environment? Oh, I'm in an airport right now. There's like a whole electromagnetic, I mean, the neuroception in our body is going wild, tracking all of these things that our nervous system wasn't designed to experience.
Right.
So when you think about it like that, like, oh, it's just my body doing what it's supposed to do. I feel like it kind of takes some of the like scary mystery out of some of the things, like even with trauma, when people are talking about trauma, like so many people, which is why I want to reach mainstream people, they're still thinking about the event, traumatic event, right? Just, oh, you're talking about the event. No, I haven't had some big event in my life, or like, right. I didn't go to war, or I didn't get raped or something exactly. like that. That's not what we're talking about. Like, no. There's
it's part
a spectrum
of it.
Sure. There's a spectrum of trauma, right? There's capital T trauma and there's, you know, lowercase t trauma. And these things happen to us, and it could be a big thing that happens, or it could be like, you know, dad saying after Bobby's baseball game, Bobby's 5 years old, you know, Bobby, maybe baseball's not for you. And then for the rest of Bobby's life, he's not good enough. And he's dealing with this like wound of not being good enough to yep. his father. And then that's this like core wound. And then his actions and behavior,
his persona
that he's completely
shapes,
yeah. not aware of
right.
is in the driver's seat his entire life, which is actually what Shithouse is about, because you start to really see how you're not in the driver's seat. Like everything that we've ever learned, I mean, everything we've ever experienced, we're learning, and then that becomes our personality. And right. then we don't even realize we have a choice. Like my mom, all the things she told me, I'm like, well, this is what's true, right?
Yeah.
And then like, who's in the bus? Who's driving the bus? Not even my mom, not even my grandmother. And so by the end of the book, you see this kind of anatomy of learned behavior.
Yeah, it's like
and
seven generations.
This is, yeah, well, that's what they say,
deep.
Right?
Yeah.
And so there's this anatomy of learned behavior, and at the end of the book, there's no one to blame.
Yeah.
And that's the healing.
Well, there's no one to blame, and
I mean, my mom is not to blame. It's
right.
just like, I can't even find anyone right. to blame.
But you can now be the one that says, oh, well, now that I know that, I'm going to take responsibility and do the best I can.
I'm doing that.
Right? That's what yeah. we're doing, right? You, me,
yep. Yep.
our friends. And to me, it's interesting because when I did research on all the possible traumas linked to ADHD, one of the big ones was circumcision. And if you think about
totally.
It, boys get circumcised, right?
Yeah.
The majority of boys are diagnosed. And there's, you could say for one boy, man, not a big deal. For that nervous system, he seems okay. For another, that could be devastating,
totally.
Right? Depending on the medication given, the circumstances
yeah.
and all that stuff. So we just quickly go, oh, no, that can't be it. No, that's not it, right? But there's research papers. And that's just one out of thousands of things, like you said, lowercase trauma, medium, yeah. you know, capital. And at the same time, we go like, no, I didn't have any drama. You know, I always say that just because there was no drama doesn't mean there's no trauma.
Yeah, but you know? Well, that's also an kind of like the easy road,
yeah.
you know, because you, but then that doesn't mean that it doesn't affect you. You know, it doesn't mean that you're not going to have some sort of like disease or, you know, illness down the line that is from this suppression of this thing that you aren't even aware of. And
right.
and that's a part of it. It's like, I think that there's, you know, on one end, there's people who have been through things that they're aware of, but they don't want to do the work because it's hard. It's
yeah,
confrontational,
it is.
You know, and I it's gross. Like it's
right.
mucky, gross. I mean, this is the whole kind of,
it's like cleaning toilets.
Yeah. And the analogy of the lotus too, right? It's like the lotus has to like go up, and we've all heard this, right? Like through the mud, and then it blossoms. And
yeah.
I mean, I feel like it got worse for me because I was diagnosed with PTSD in 2013, which like gave me language for what I was experiencing for the first time, because I was having really bad ADD symptoms.
Childhood PTSD kind of,
I mean, all of it is connected, right? It's like,
right.
I was, the diagnosis was because of, an event that was the tip of the iceberg.
Got it.
Right. That's the car accident was, you know, sticking its head out of the water. But below that was all of this other stuff that had happened to me in my life that, you know, reinforced that the world is not a safe place to live. And then when I got in that car accident and I had no control over other, I mean, it's just all the things that were already there, everything bubbled to the surface. And like at the core of it, I went through 2 years of EMDR, you know, doing trauma therapy mm-hmm. after this. And it got worse before it got better, which means my symptoms got way worse because then I was digging into it, right? It's like, and we weren't titrating it. You know, we were going right in into the therapy. And then it was like, I was annihilated for several days. So I get why people don't want to do the work.
Yeah.
Because it's fucking hard.
It's uncomfortable. Yeah.
And then there's the people who don't know. They don't know that there's things, our bodies are so, and our psychology is so brilliant because it's all working in service of survival. So even the dissociation, even the ability for a brain or a brain body to compartmentalize things and to shrink a hippocampus so you can't even remember things. Like yeah. that's how brilliant the body is because you need to keep going.
Well, that's what I always say. I have this theory that all these people, even if you get older, yes, your body's getting older, your brain and all that stuff. But I believe that when people start forgetting things, it's actually unconsciously purpose. It's on purpose.
Yeah.
Because they started to train their brain that certain things I don't want to remember. I don't want to remember this. And so then the memory gets kind of like lazy. Like, okay, yeah, not remembering stuff. Okay, fine.
That's
and
it.
You start forgetting, right? Yeah. It's a muscle and you yeah. eventually.
Well, they say that in ADHD, both the amygdala and the hippocampus is smaller, right? So it's like, in a way.
Again, it's trained, right? It's yeah, like.
I mean, it's all trained. It's all trained. And that's the thing about, that's the paradox, I would say, of healing, because our biology is really strong, right? So like you want to follow your biology, right? You want to, your heart is racing or you feel lethargic. Like I always go, I always talk about heart racing first because my propensity or my default is anxiousness, right? I've never, I have so much energy. And so I've never really experienced the other thing, which actually my sister experiences, depression. You know, she gets really, you know, really low energy, but wait, I was going to go somewhere with that. Oh, so the paradox of healing. So when these physiological responses come online, they're so strong. I mean, they take over all your neuroendocrine structures, right? The key, and then what do? We follow them, right? We follow them. My heart is racing. Oh God. You start panicking and then you make it worse. And the next thing you know, you have a panic attack. But what you really have to do to heal is the counterintuitive thing. Now that's not going to happen unless you are so acutely aware of what is happening inside of your body, which is why the educational kind of the bioeducation is so important, or the biopsycho and social education is so important.
Yeah.
Because what do? Like even people who show up to my yoga class, I see it all the time because I see people's nervous systems just standing next to them. And then I see their nervous system playing out through their practice. So you get people and they come in and they do the same thing again and again and again and again and again. And then they're like, I'm not getting better. It's because you keep doing the same thing that's perpetuating their responses in the first place,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
In order to get better, you actually have to become aware of what you're doing, and then you have to do the opposite. Yeah. So like in the yoga room, I'm always like, okay, the type A personality, raise your hand, me, I'm like triple type A, right? It's like me. Okay, so all of you guys don't need to do extra chaturangas. You need a nap. You people just lay on the ground and like give yourself a moment. Maybe do half. Do half of what you normally would do. Like let your system calm down a little bit. Let it land. Let it integrate. You don't need to do more things that raise your heart rate. Your heart rate is just doing that because that's its reflexive right? And then the people who are more like lethargic or apathetic, or they don't want to do all the things, they need to do more. And so that is also the hard part, is like the healing is counterintuitive. We keep thinking that we need to like go down the rabbit hole of like doing more. And I do feel like, you know, this culture of social media I mean, there's so many facilitators now, there's not even anyone to facilitate to. Like everyone's a facilitator.
Everyone's a coach. Everyone's
that's
a facilitator.
What I mean.
Everybody has a podcast.
That's what I mean. So it's funny because I'm like, maybe I should start a podcast. And then I'm like, no, you know, I'm having a moment in my life where I'm trying to undo my reflexivity towards doing.
Yeah.
I am a mega doer.
You're ungrinding.
And so people lately have been like, well, what do you do? which is like, I want to tell all the people all the things I do, but then I don't have the business anymore that closed down because the property sold. I'm just in graduate school. But I can feel myself want to prove.
Yeah. That you're doing stuff.
Yes.
I'm doing stuff.
Yes. Yeah. So lately I'm aware of that, you know, default mechanism in me. And so I've been telling people, like at the beginning, you said, you're a busy woman. I'm actually not that busy right now. I'll tell you what I do. I walk, not run. And that's on purpose. I'm trying to slow down. My heart is always beating fast. My heart rate variability is low because it's always on the same speed. So I've been trying to work on taking it down. I go to Pilates. I enjoy nature and I go to school. Like, this is huge for me to not be doing 50 million things. And there's there's something I want to get myself into right now.
And you're writing your book and you're dabbling in real estate still, right? I mean,
I am doing stuff, but yeah. I just mean, I don't have a public brick and mortar where I'm doing, you know, 50 million things right now. I'm working on my second book, but I'm actually more, kind of consumed by graduate school right now. Graduate school is like a lot of the work that I'm doing is based on American Psychological Association. So it's this very boring template you have to write in, which totally strips me of my creativity. It's the opposite of, you know, kind of creative nonfiction, which is my next book. But part of why I wrote the first book kind of like story form, like interesting story form, but also educational, is because not everyone can handle curriculum. Like if you look at The Body Keeps the Score, that book is so heavily curriculum based. Nobody can read that unless they have the kind of attentional capacity for that sort of information. Right. I like it. But most of the people that talk about, oh, you know, The Body Keeps the Score, guarantee you they haven't read that. If that was a hard book for me to read, that's a hard book for like most people to read.
Yeah.
So it's easier to like share information, which like the next book is this wild story, weird matrix I got myself into over the last several years. But the idea is to show through story form the anatomy of how we've built our bodies through all these people's kind of different experience that we all end up colliding together, and it's a true story that's like totally wild and fucked up and you can't make it up. But I think it's really captivating to tell stories that are educational versus just research, because that's a certain sort of faculty, you know?
Well, that's been my challenge too, right? It's like doing a documentary, doing the podcast on ADHD. I get these experts with these books. When I interview Gabor Mate or Bessel van der Kolk, I don't read their entire library of books that they've written, right?
Yeah.
I don't have time. I don't understand it. But that's why I do the podcast, because in an hour I can ask questions, they give answers, and in the end you kind of get it. You're like, okay, I got it. I don't have to practice this. I don't have to explain it or write a paper. But I can now tell parents, The Body Keeps the Score is about this idea that the trauma gets stuck in the body, and unless you release it somehow, it's still there, still with you. But you have the power to release it or process it, right?
But then, it seems so woo-woo for people that they have a hard time wrapping their brain around that.
It does, and I think we're just, I don't want to say ahead of our time, but it's the beginning of that, right?
Yeah.
Where that will eventually be a Bible, where people go like, oh yeah, you have to read this in school. Like kids have to know about the body shaking things out. Like when my kids were at this school in LA called Play Mountain Place, it was this total nature, no homework, no grades. Kids could do whatever they wanted all day long, right? And there was this room.
Is it kind of like Waldorf?
No, because Waldorf is still very like structured and educational. Okay. And it was just wild.
Yeah, great.
Like mud balls and shit, right? And so they had this room where they hung on strings. They hung these recycled, empty water gallons containers, like 20 of them on the ceiling. And then there was a bunch of sticks they made out of newspapers. And whenever somebody was angry, including teachers, you'd go in there and you just like smack it out, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I was always that is wild. But then when I came across some of the research, I was like, oh, this is fucking brilliant.
Yeah, this makes
sense. Because they needed to get that thing out, and then they would return to the classroom or whatever they were doing. They're like, I'm good. And I was like, we don't do that in society.
Yeah.
We stuff it down, or tap it down, right? Stuff it in, we keep it down, we repress it, suppress it, depress it. It's all those pressions, right?
But then,
it explodes.
But it's manifesting in people's bodies.
Disorders, diseases, yep.
Well, so one of the things with somatic experiencing is like your somatic experiencing is a very elusive thing to try to articulate exactly what it is, because it's not exactly what it is. There is no exact formula or method. But, you know, one of the big kind of components is that you're trying to complete incomplete survival responses. So by being a somatic experiencing practitioner, you essentially become an expert of a nervous system. And your job is to kind of co-regulate, like be in working with clients. If you're going to work with clients, you're helping to kind of co-regulate that person, but you're kind of tracking their system to see where it's getting stuck or where there's a hiccup. And then through a variety of outlets, you're kind of helping them resolve that,
complete that
yeah. incomplete response. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
With the nervous system, you know, what goes up must come back down, but also what goes down, because there's this whole kind of misunderstood, actually, I just was at a retreat this weekend with someone who's like a total expert, and even he had this wrong. And so the dorsal vagal complex, which is like the bottom of the vagus nerve, it's a parasympathetic response. It's like where the freeze response live, or where the fainting response live, but it's kind of like a hybrid response. Like when your body can't discharge this survival energy, this sympathetic energy, and there's nowhere for it to go. Say you're getting held down. Your body will go into this preservation response, and you could faint. You could go into extreme dissociation. But I do feel like this is what's happening for a lot of people now. You know, they think that they're having, like an anxiety attack or like a sympathetic. It's like everyone knows about the sympathetic, but what we don't understand is that there's actually kind of the heightened threat response of the parasympathetic nervous system. So like the fainting response would be the extreme response of the parasympathetic nervous system. So the parasympathetic is not all good. You actually have the like threat response on that. And so for me, that's how I ended up getting into this work, is because when I was a kid going into kindergarten, they tried to give me the vaccines to go into kindergarten, and they held me down. And I said, I'm not ready. And my mom said, just hold her down and give her the shots. And I went away. I fainted. I seized. I peed my pants. I shit my pants. And after that, and then I shook and seized for like 30 seconds. And then after they had given me the shots, they let go of my body, and my body came to at some point. And after that, because we're associative learners, anything that made me feel that level of fear, the scent of that room, a doctor's office, doctors, white coats,
needles,
all of it became a trigger to go into dorsal vagal immobility. So from the beginning of my life, I have had a fainting response. And it's not just fainting, it's faint and seize. Animals do this. This is animals feigning dead in the wild, right? I'm not consciously like, okay, now I'm going to immobilize. No, I'm not.
Right.
That's
just
not
happens.
It just happens. And so our bodies have a whole world below words that we, as the, you know, caretakers or livers inside these bodies, need to become attuned to, because it's going to help us. Like, that's what's going to help us kind of heal our trauma. Because for me, the fact that I had had this response in front of doctors and they didn't really know what it was, they call it vasovagal syncope, right? But they're like, we don't know why. It's just like, you're giving yourself a panic attack. And that's what they told me from the very, you are giving yourself a panic attack. And I became so afraid of my own body, because so many of the conditions in the world started to mirror. And so I was afraid, my world got very small, right? Because I was having this, this was happening to me all the time. I'd sprain my ankle and I'd think I'd have to go to the doctor. Boom, I'm fainting before I even get there, right? I couldn't go get a diagnosis or a prescription for it because they're going to say that I'm epileptic and take my driver's license away, right? So when I'm, there's a whole, like, it's a very scary place to be, but that's what brought me into all of this work is I needed to understand what was happening to me to be able, because below that response is fear of death. That's all of our, you know, biggest fears. Yep. And so I had to understand what that thing was, what I needed to understand all the symptomatology. And like, I was getting breadcrumbs, like for the last 15 years, 20 years, actually, I've been getting breadcrumbs about what this response is that doctors couldn't quite tell me this is exactly what it is, which is your vagus nerve comes in too hot. It drops. It's trying to put the brake on your sympathetic nervous system. It drops your heart rate so fast that you faint and you end up seizing. For me, that's my, you know, response, that's the symptoms. Or, but anyway, so I have now been 4 years, 4 years. I was 38. I'm 41. I don't know. I'm 3 or 4 years free of having a dorsal vagal immobility collapse.
Wow.
I know how to interrupt it. I know the symptoms. And if I can do it, everyone can do it. So that's part of why I've become such an advocate of understanding your body and your nervous system, because this thing that was my big trauma and my biggest fear, now that I understand how my body works, it's not so scary. I know what the triggers are. I know how to calm my system down. I know how to discharge the energy. What do I not do? Stay still. No, you got to discharge the energy. It could be through humming. You could gargle. You could scream. You know, that's all stimulating for your vagus nerve. You can shake. The interesting thing is with your heart rate dropping really fast, you would think that you need to breathe deep, but you actually have to breathe faster to take your heart rate back up. So like I said, it's really counterintuitive.
Right.
And following the biology, you know, your physiology is like so intoxicating. How do you stop that? When all of a sudden you feel like you're going to faint, you just go with it. And so people keep strengthening that response. But really what people need to do is become so aware of their symptoms that they can disrupt their symptoms.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a long monologue.
But. No, that's a great story because it's kind of in parallel if you think about ADHD, right? When we say, oh, why does this person have ADHD? Because they have ADHD.
Yeah.
We don't go deeper. We don't go, what has them behave that
exactly.
way?
Exactly. I mean, this goes back to my friend and her child mirroring her nervous system.
Yeah.
So this child is learning how to be in the world, how to respond to things, you know, how to pay attention, how to not pay attention, what gets paid attention to through like by witnessing the caregivers and the,
Yeah. I mean, it's so one of the things I've actually come to, and as I was, taking a course with, not famous, but one of the top experts around sex addiction, Dr. Skinner in Utah.
Yeah.
And I remember asking him at some point, I said, could it be that ADHD is like an addiction? And he's like, never thought about that. And later he came back to me and he said, well, it's definitely very similar because Gabor Mate says it's a coping mechanism, right? Yeah. What's an addiction? It's like you can't cope with this moment. You're bored, you're depressed, you're whatever. You don't want to be here. You start using something to check out, right? And so in with ADHD, you start wanting to not be here, but over there where it's shiny or fun or more exciting, or don't want to be here because I'm unsafe and uncomfortable, right? So it's a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
Guess what? That's learned.
Yeah.
Right? And so then we don't ask, like, why is the child uncomfortable?
Yeah.
What's going on in the body? What's going on in the mind, right?
But it's also like an unaware addiction, right? Because
Of course.
It is...
Most of them start that way though.
Well, like, I just mean for like a you know, an adult or a child who has ADHD. They're not. So Stephen Porges, who's the guy who created the polyvagal theory, he says that it's our reflexivity that is creating our suffering. Okay. So like I was saying about the intoxication of physiology. So when your brain structures and your neurostructures are programmed a certain way, your default is to go toward that, right? Your default is to just go where you've already been. That's the mm-hmm. algorithm, go where you've already been. So for a child, how do they become aware of that? They're going to keep defaulting to what they've right. defaulted to before.
Yeah,
right?
it's unconscious.
That's
yeah.
what I mean. So they're not even, it's this yeah. addiction that's like, it's like a silent kind of like unaware addiction because you're
it's a programmed
you
addiction.
Fall
right?
back into this pattern, yeah. right?
Yeah, exactly.
But there's a way through and a way out. And that's partly, I think right now, I was listening to this talk that Jeff Bezos did, and I actually was really not a fan of Jeff Bezos until I listened to this very specific talk. And I was like, this guy is fucking smart, actually. He was saying that there is no better time to do all of this kind of attentional work, whether it's meditation, whether it's yoga, whether it's, you know, whatever it is. Like, there's no better time than right now to do it, because he's like, take it from me, someone who works with technology. Technology and the technology that's being developed, all of it is designed to basically like captivate your attention in shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and yeah. shorter periods yeah. of time. And it, yeah. and they're bringing in, you know, neuroscientists, they're bringing in psychologists now to work with these marketing teams to be able to kind of target ads that kind of work at the same pace as, you know, where the human attention span is now, which is like when the, right. When the iPhone was developed in 2001, it was said that the human attention span was 12 seconds, right? And now we're at, well, this was 2021, but it's like 8.5 seconds, which is less than a goldfish, right? A goldfish is 9 right. seconds, right? Mm-hmm. And kids, like, what do we want to do with our like annoying ADHD child? Put them in front of a screen, just right. shut the fuck up and get, but that's actually perpetuating the very, yeah. yeah. So Jeff Bezos was saying that like, this is what we need. We need to do attention-based practices because all the things out there, I mean, everything in our society is there to hijack
it's
your
going
attention.
The opposite direction.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, it's feeding the algorithms, right? Because they need to study the patterns. And so then we give them our attention. It's almost like in the Matrix, the humans gave the energy, but we give the attention is a commodity, right?
Well, and now there's click farms too. You know, they just got, you know about this, right?
No.
It sounds
scary.
Yeah, it's scary because everything comes down to the, you know, social media algorithm. If you want your post to go, it needs to get clicked many, 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 yep. many times. So people are paying these programs, and these programs are like these, you know, companies that hire all of these people like in Africa, and they've got all of them, you know, in a room, not all of them, but like giant groups of people clicking, 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 clicking yep. to be able to up the algorithm. So,
yep.
I mean, like one of the most dangerous things of our time is social media. I mean, and I don't know, because I wasn't going to, if when I was a teenager, when I was a kid, I mean, I was just like, my parents are stupid. So I wasn't going to listen to what anyone told me. I don't know what the answer is, but what I do know is people need an outlet for their energy. We need to move.
Yeah.
Movement is, and metabolism is the basis of life, and the end, the cessation of metabolism is the end of life. And we need attention-based practices. And I'm so passionate yeah. about that.
We need silence.
Totally. I mean, that's an attention-based practice, right?
Right. Right. Meditation. Yeah.
But the hard thing about that is, and like speaking, coming from someone who, because I had this physical trauma, my body was not a safe place to be. So when I started my yoga career, I'm 19 years old and I'm taking these classes, and the beginning of the class is a meditation or breath work that gets my heart rate to mirror that trauma response. It's fucking scary.
Yeah.
I couldn't sit. I couldn't do any sort of breath work because breath holds would bring me to that state of dorsal vagal where I could feel like, you know, my blood pressure dropping and, you know, the ringing in my ears. And, and then the fast breathing practices, pranayama, would mirror the anxiousness that I wasn't able to resolve, which crossed me over into preservation mode, right?
Yeah.
So my body was not a safe place to be. Sitting was next to impossible, and movement was my outlet. So I loved these crazy wild vinyasa classes. Now I hate them, by the way. Like, the last thing I need a nap. I mean, you guys have listened to me now going for an hour. Like, there's a lot always happening inside of me. Like, I don't need to go into an environment and do more. Yeah. I need to do less.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, the way I found, I had to train my attentional faculties. I had to train my mind. I had to train my neurophysiology to be able to sit and become sensitive enough that I could feel the kind of echo of these practices and what they did to my physiology. That's hard for a kid, but it's in, this is like, I feel I'm kind of like the anti-yoga person. I don't have a yoga voice. I'm not like Om Shanti, you know, I'm not telling, archetypal mythological stories from, you know, I'm just, that's not for me. The forum of yoga is literally to teach people about how their body mind works and about all these attentional practices that ultimately will change your life.
Right. And I think that's a general statement for our society. I think we all need to slow down. And I don't mean slow down in a typical how we hear it all the time. Oh, you got to slow down. Really, like, we have to start doing less, taking more time to be quiet, like do all the attentional practices. And then our being shifts and we'll attract more things we want anyway. We're going to have less of the grind energy that the world is promoting that attracts all sorts of trouble and frenetic, you know, shit. I call them the dark spirals of all the depression and anxiety and divorces and fighting and all that stuff is all in because we're trying to do too much and we're trying to get somewhere. Yeah. We're not going anywhere.
That was wait, do we still have a little bit of time?
Of course.
Okay. That was a big, such a game changer for me because I spent so much of my life suffering. When I found yoga, I really got swept up on the magic carpet of it. Like, I was just like, oh, we're getting enlightened. Like, where are we going? Are we getting on, you know, in a spaceship and we're going to I'll go anywhere you want. Like, just get me out of this. Right. And then through the many years that I've been doing this work and then starting to study the body, I realized like, oh, this is it. We're not going anywhere. So we better figure out how to live in this body.
We're already there.
This is it. This is it. And that is actually, there's a Sanskrit mantra, which is Om Tat Sat. And it means this is it. Like, this is it. Like, this is literally it. Mm. So, you know, the teachers that are teaching, like, you're going to transcend yourself to like a different time and place. Like, I don't know. For me, enlightenment is learning how to be in this body, you know, through all of the crazy, fucking uncomfortable, fucked up shit that's going on. And
find your peace where you're at now.
And choosing where I put my attention and energy. But I do have to say, because I was thinking of this earlier, and I think it's very, 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 very important for people to do good stress practices. So Peter Levine, the guy who created Somatic Experiencing and wrote Waking the Tiger, which is the best trauma book on the market, Waking the Tiger. I get money from that. No, I'm just kidding.
I do. Exactly. No one does.
No. But it's like the most easily digestible, you know, book out there. But he says the best thing that we can do for our system is to stir it up and settle it down over and over again, because that's resiliency. And the more you can feel your system settling down, like you feel yourself go up and you feel yourself come back down, or you feel yourself go down. And there's lots of ways you can actually do that practice too, like with breath holds, you know, that sort of thing. And then you feel your physiology kind of come back to kind of like this moving homeostasis, which they now call allostasis. It's like balance while there's movement going on, right? Mm-hmm. That's the best thing we can do for our system. So because then you trust, we're associative learners, right? You know the impact of doing hard things, and you also know you've resolved this specific kind of physiological states enough times that you know that there can be resolution. You've done these practices enough like say you're, you know, you're doing these practices, you're getting in a cold plunge, you feel your heart, you mm-hmm. calm your heart down. You're like, I can do this, right? Yeah. Like I know how to do this, right? And then you get into the car and you're driving on the 405 through LA and you're stuck in traffic. And then your body starts having that same physiological response. And you're like, oh, I can do this.
Yeah.
I can do this. That's how I started getting in a car and driving again after that car accident. I didn't drive on the freeway for 10 years.
Wow.
Through my whole, till I was 38, like 28 to 38. I did not drive a car long distance. But I had to face my fear. And that means I had to get into the car and drive the car again on a freeway in traffic and all the, you know, circumstances. And I had to use all of my tools that I had learned to calm my physiology down.
Mm-hmm.
And now I drive. Now I love driving.
Amazing.
I know.
I have a friend who also, until recently, hasn't done any freeway driving for probably 15 years.
It's scary.
Now he's doing it. Still, he's still a little wonky about it.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, you know, I'm going to, down to Murrieta this weekend, for a ceremony. And, he's like, please drive because he's going with me. He's like, can you drive? I'm like, I'll drive, you know,
good practice though, is him being in the, him driving with you in the car, because then you have the social support of that.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And that's how I started. I first was practicing with people in the car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bring a dummy. Yeah.
No, you're the dummy.
I'm the dummy. He's bringing a dummy. Oh, that's funny. So where is this all going, right? So you grew up, you were said to have ADHD. Your mom said, nope, I'm going to keep her busy, put her in sports. You were never medicated.
No.
Do you, at what point did you feel like you had a handle on your, let's call it the ADHD type of behavior, meaning I can't pay attention? What point did you feel like you had a handle on it and you're now using it, or you've designed your life so that you can function the way you function and still create results in life?
Yeah. I mean, I would love to say that like this started when I was 4 years old and then like 2 years later, I was great. That's not the truth. The reality is it takes a very long time to create a body, and it takes a long time to kind of unravel a body. And not like, not so long, like I don't want to, you know, freak anyone out or deter anyone from doing this work. But, I would say that for real, like 2 years ago, I got to a place where I feel, like I can completely regulate my system. It doesn't mean that my system doesn't do all the things that it normally does. You know, it means that I know how, when things come up, I know how to meet them, you know? But the big game changer, and I know that this is a byproduct of privilege, but we moved to Ojai, and being here and out of the city, because Stephen Porges talks about this idea of neuroception, which is really that your body is scanning. And this is where I feel like people who have ADHD, it's like hard, you know, it's the paradox. Like it's hard to get out of that when you're living in an environment that is constantly triggering all of your alarm systems.
Right.
So, you know, if your body is designed, you know, you've got this is essentially your nervous system, but it's called coined neuroception, and it's that your body's constantly scanning the environment for mm-hmm. threats of danger.
Yeah.
I would love to say that it's safety, but it's actually negativity bias. It's survival. It's first and foremost is their danger. Right?
It wants you to be safe.
Yeah,
but
it does.
Has to scan for unsafety.
Yeah. Exactly. And so our systems are just like on, and they're reactive because that's what they're designed to do protect us and to keep us alive.
But it's no longer the saber-toothed tiger.
No.
It's now your boss, or the nasty billboard you're looking at, or the loud noise at night.
That's
or,
what I mean.
Or school.
Or you don't even notice it because that's what I was saying. Like we lived in Encinitas. The train can be heard everywhere. The train is constantly going. You have the buzz of the 5. You've got the 101. You have all of these, you know, kind of low frequency,
background
high frequency.
Noise.
Yeah. That you aren't really aware of with like consciously with your own ear, but your body is aware of all of it.
Yeah.
And so when we moved to Ojai there, we had been coming up here and we knew there was something we liked about it. But at the very beginning, I don't think we could articulate that it was how we felt.
Yeah.
So now we live in nature, which is what we're, how we're designed to live. Right. And that's, but again, like we're lucky. We're lucky that we can be here and that we don't have to be in the city because of a job. And so like, I think that changing the conditions, my living conditions, was huge. And so now I meet all of these people and they've got Crohn's, they've got alopecia, they've got leaky gut, they've got, and I'm just like, oh my God, leave the city.
Yeah.
Leave the city. Reconnect your vagus nerve. You know, like be in nature, do some cold plunges, breathe, calm down.
Try whatever. It's almost like trial by error. You have to just try things and check them off the list and go, that was okay. Yeah. This didn't work. That actually worked.
But you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And we didn't know. Like it wasn't until I got here and I was like, whoa. I mean, not got here, living here for like living here for at least 6 months. And I was like, oh, this is how I'm supposed to feel.
Well, that's what we did with our son. We left, same thing. We came to Ojai because we wanted to not medicate him and get, you know, move to nature and eat better and sleep better. Right.
Yeah.
But then we slowed down automatically. We started doing less and being more. And that's a whole other podcast. But like our son changed.
Yeah.
His nervous system calmed down because we calmed down. And now he's a straight A student, not medicated in an academic school that is not easy. And he's self-motivated.
Yeah.
And he has no support. He's like, Dad, I don't want any of the 529 or IEP. I don't want a crutch. I'm going to do the thing. And we're like, fine, do whatever. Do the best you can. Straight A's. We're like, amazing. You don't have to have straight A's, but good for you. He's like, no, I'm going to do even better. I'm like, great.
Well, and there's something I do think that our attention is our most, you know, precious natural resource because.
Yep. Hey, I say that.
Oh, yeah.
You know how I phrase it? Every time I end my online podcasts I do, I say your attention's your most valuable commodity.
It's true.
It's true.
And if you think about, we each, I mean, this is what I believe. I believe that all of us have I don't know if it's destiny, but I think we all have like a purpose, you know, in our life. And if you don't have the attentional capacity to follow that, you're not going to be happy.
Right.
And it takes, like I'm watching, I have people in my life that there's something that they want to do and I know it and they can't get off social media. They can't regulate their body. So they smoke weed, just like mega.
That's where all the addictions come in, right? Yeah, porn.
It's a coping mechanism.
Food,
right?
All of it.
And then they're not motivated to do the thing that it actually takes to do the thing, right? Yeah. I will say that book took me 7 years and I followed it all the way through. I was 38 years old when I went back to college. I was 40 years old when I started graduate school. Like I keep going, but there's something about, it's almost like I'm disciplining my own attention by doing what I'm doing, but that's what it takes to be able to create the things in our life that are fulfilling and give us happiness. You have to be able to pay attention long enough to be able to get yourself there.
Well, I always say that manifestation requires attention or an intention.
Right, exactly.
And if you don't, you're just not creating it, it's fine. You still have a life.
Yeah.
But, and I'm in that boat too, where sometimes I'm so not present and distracted. I'm not inspired. Inspiration is another one. You need inspiration, attention, intention. It takes practice.
So much practice, daily practice. But that's also another.
That's Adderall, whichever.
Man. I mean, I think it takes people years to get off Adderall because of the kind of addictive qualities of it. But like, to bounce back, which we can totally bounce back. Yeah. That's what every cell in your body is designed to do, is repair itself.
Right.
But it takes a little bit of time and it comes with some suffering in there because your body is trying to self-organize again, you know?
I mean, I have no judgment. You do you, right? If somebody wants to do Adderall and be more productive, I had a bunch of my...
No judgment, but we'll judge you when we get off this podcast.
That's right. And I won't mention any names now, but I'll tell you later.
Yes.
Some of my top experts I've interviewed all said, yeah, I take Adderall when I need to finish my book sometimes.
Wow.
You know, but they said I'm an adult and I only take it, say, 2 days a week when I'm writing, not 7 days a week.
Yeah.
Right. For like 5 hours. and then they're done. So you could say they're more responsible, they're adults, their brains
are
fully formed.
How about go to sleep, get some sleep, so that way you have, you know, the next day you have the ability to pay attention and do the work. Yeah, take it to drink a coffee.
Coffee's a stimulant, obviously, it's a little softer, but...
Mm-hmm. And your energy drink that sponsors this podcast called...
Zero. Go get some Zahiro. Because it is good. You're laughing, but it's true. I love Zero. I was actually skeptical.
I don't need any more energy.
I was skeptical though. I was like, and then I tried it and I was like, actually everything they said and described is accurate. So I got to give them that.
Okay, great.
I don't take it every day, but you know, we'll have a shot.
Maybe
afterwards.
I can get some kickback.
Exactly. Well, I think we've done a nice 1.0. It's 1:11 right now, 1:11 p.m., which is great. And we'll do like a second version at some point down the road, you know, follow up maybe when your book is done or when you have your master's or...
Almost there.
Or really?
Ooh, yeah.
When?
December, I graduate.
Perfect.
Yeah.
We'll have to do like a January 25. It's going to be already 25. Follow-up podcast.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing all your... knowledge, wisdom, input, experience, you know. I think we went into some really cool rabbit holes.
Yeah, I love that.
Me too.
Yeah, squirrel.
It's been a pleasure. Shiny thing.
Exactly.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.